Hi, I'm Bob Mankoff. I'm cartoon editor of the New Yorker magazine, and I'm also, fortunately, a cartoonist for the magazine.
As a cartoonist, how do you perceive the world?
I think you perceive it like everybody else does on one level. I had to get to the studio, make sure the car was there and all of that. At the same time, you're always looking at it in another way also, looking at everything we take for granted as also absurd.
So is it sort of like magic eye? You're going through the world and these moments are leaping out at you that no one else can see?
Well, I think everybody sees them because I think everybody has a sense of humor. One of the things is they just don't file them away. They're not, it's not their occupation. But I think having a sense of humor has become sort of a cardinal virtue. Interestingly, if you do a Google search, you won't even see the phrase sense of humor occur before the 1860s. It becomes a very, very powerful concept. And it's very powerful now in our time because life is such a mashup. There's so many things coming at us from the internet and everything else that one of the ways to deal with it is by being funny. All the absurdities, you know, you go into Starbucks. You're the only person there, and they're still asking you for your name. And so I was in Starbucks, and a young lady asked me for my name. And I said, I'm the only person here. She said, no, we really need your name. I say, okay, Steve, but that's not my real name.
You're also a cartoon editor. How do you know when something is funny?
Obviously, you know when something is funny in that it makes you laugh. Unfortunately, when you're looking at 1,000 cartoons, that's not going to be available to you anymore. You're going to have to use some sort of a judgment. So part of the judgment is experience, and part of the judgment is really, I mean, a philosophy of humor. You know, E.B. White said, analyzing humor is like dissecting a frog. Nobody's much interested in the frog dies. But you need that type of analysis a little bit to distinguish. What type of joke is it? Is this observational humor, you know, in which a man is saying to the woman, his wife, he's saying, is there anything else more I can do for you wrong? And that's sort of the relationship men have with women, often failing with the task that they're sent. Is it crazy humor? Is it called paninis of the old West, where there's a panini being put on the railroad tracks and being tied up by a villain? That's really so strange. Or is it like a cartoon like mine, in which the executive is on the phone and he's saying, no, Thursday's out. How about never? It's never good for you, which deals with our harried lives, and it's identification humor. We identify with them. And what makes that funny, in my opinion, how funny works, funny is a type of incongruity, a type of surprise. He's starting off with a polite message. He's ending rude. You actually then have a mashup of both things. The syntax is polite. The message is rude. And that is sort of not necessarily a formula for humor, but one of the ways that humor works. So if you look at humor monolithically, and you're looking at 1,000 things that way, you know, eventually it will drive you mad and not lead to laughter. So I need that sort of categorization for myself.
And so when you're working with another artist, are you saying much the same kind of thing a book editor says? I'm not quite getting your character. There's something in this narrative that's missing. Is it the same type of thing?
Well, sometimes, you know, like I said, it could be just, you know, the punch. If it's someone who's starting off, a young cartoonist. So let's say I have a cartoon in which there's a board member saying, "Gentlemen, the upside potential is tremendous, but the downside is jail." Okay, that cartoon does not work as "Gentlemen, the downside is jail, but the upside potential is tremendous." So sometimes it's just the structure. Punchlines come at the end. They're surprised. They switch the narrative. You know. You'll be awake during the entire operation. That sounds like a good thing. The anesthesiologist is on vacation. That's a very bad thing. So something, it'll be like that. Sometimes what I advise them on is not the structure, because one of the things people don't realize, cartoonists are doing 10, 15 cartoons every week if they're professionals. My job there is selection, and David Remnick's is too. I'm not going to, every once in a while, I'll make a comment. It's a younger cartoonist coming up, and where they want to know not only about the nuts and bolts, but about the creative process itself and the idea that you got to do lots and lots of bad material to get to good material. That the difference between a professional and an amateur is that an amateur thinks everything they do is good, and a professional thinks most of the stuff they do doesn't quite make it. And so you have to have that mindset, partly during the creative act of not editing, and understanding that didn't work. Then when you get feedback, don't personalize it. Bob Mankoff, what a jerk. And did you see his hair? He didn't even comb it. You know, it's where everything becomes personal, you know, you. And you have to have resilience and grit. You have to have all these things. So I one of the things when people come into my office is I'm not actually looking for cartoons. I'm looking for cartoonists, people who can do this thing, who can deal creatively in a world of rejection, still maintain their work ethic and sense of humor and get satisfaction out of it. And that's a rare group of people. So that's what I do.
And your book is to some extent about that odyssey in your own life.
Yeah, it's the odyssey in my own life. And partly the book is, I mean, I've been making this joke a couple of times. Why not make it again? It's a good joke. Is that I grew up in New York City, in Queens, Jewish culture, very, very focused on achievement and professions and all that. So there's a Jewish joke in which the woman is walking with her kids and someone asks them how old, and the mother says, the doctor is 6, the lawyer is 4. But I wasn't like that. And one of the purposes of my book is to encourage creativity, that you should not be defined by your standard test scores. You did well on the MCA, the MCAT, whatever it is for medicine, therefore you have to be a doctor. Great cartoonists we now have. Ben Schwartz gave up being a doctor to be a cartoonist. There's something to be said for the creative life. And really, with where computers are going now, there's an awful lot of things that are going to be done by computers, like diagnosis or automatic analysis of legal issues. But they're not going to be able to draw the cartoons and write the jokes or the music. So it's a hymn of praise to the road that most people don't take, the creative road.
Now, you were talking about the life we're all familiar with today, which is kind of technology-ridden. What is it about cartoons that's so good at capturing just the essence of a contemporary life? I can remember whole movements that seem to me to have been summed up by New Yorker
cartoons.
Well,
of course, there's a great Peter Steiner cartoon from 1993, before anybody really knew what the Internet was, which characterized it certainly at the time, saying the two dogs in front of the computer saying, on the Internet, no one knows you're a dog. And there's an ambiguity and a loveliness about that. That life now, especially with the Internet, are these strange facades, these avatars, these alternate presences that poses us and not us.
But not just technology. This is now, of course, an institution that's been going since 1925. For every era, there seems to have been the perfect New Yorker cartoon. Why are cartoons good at that?
Because they compress everything. They need to be compressed. You're looking at it for a moment. So they compress everything down to an essence that we can identify. And if the cartoon doesn't go off, as David Remnick had said, like a little grenade, a little explosion, it doesn't work. Also, cartoons capture the essence because they're humorous. They're this little epigram. And so humor relates to us as human beings.
What's changed most for you in the whole course of your professional life in the field?
Well, I think one of the things is, as the new generations come in, is humor itself shifts, becomes a little stranger, more meta, more absurd. You know, if you go back, and like a huge influence on my own thinking at one time was Monty Python. Before Monty Python, of course, there was, you know, Spike Jonze and there was the Goon Show. But if you look at England, see, wow, it shifted. Shifted from sort of these stuffy he-she jokes or Victorian stuff to a certain type of focused insanity, a joy about the joking itself.
I hadn't realized until I started reading your book that so many captions that I remember vividly were not, in fact, supplied by the cartoonist, but by somebody else. What's that partnership about?
In the 30s, 40s, and 50s, there was a gag writing industry. But now, this started really with William Shawn, and in the book I wrote about the idea of authenticity. There was something about it that when you found out, as great as that Charles Adams cartoon was, and he certainly created a lot of his own, it wasn't his idea. It loses a little something. Very few of Peter Arnold's cartoons were his. Now, that's not to say that he wasn't a great talent. He was. He provided the milieu for that. He had done cartoons. So when you look at something that characterizes the late 20s and the 30s, it's Peter Arnold. And then you could write for that sitcom. But now people write their own sitcom.
Do they have to have different brains? I mean, for instance, your famous cartoon, it's a standard picture of an executive having
right,
a telephone
right.
conversation. Where do you have to go to say the perfect thing for him to say is blank?
Well, there is no, one of the things is, there is no perfect thing. It's an art. And so you do the best you can based on experience, craft, and dedication.
Now, I was raised on New Yorker cartoons. My American grandmother was a friend of Sid Perelman's.
Oh, wow.
I'd like to think that such intelligence as I have to offer to the world is because I grew up subversive because of this. Do you think humor in cartoons are a good child-rearing tool?
Eventually, kids, intelligent kids, 7 and 8, they start looking at the New Yorker, which they don't understand, but they start to understand the cartoons. There's a lot of research that shows humor and using humor and understanding humor actually helps not only the cognitive skills involved in understanding cartoons, but cognitive and creative skills, you know, in general.
What about creating a more balanced human being? Humor is good for that too, yes?
Well, absolutely. I think you've got to be a little unbalanced to create it, but you'll be completely unbalanced without it.
Interested in the structure of the book?
Well, I mean, I think the book is unique in a way in that I'm using images sequentially with the text as it moves. And I'm able to do that because now we have a database of all the images. So as I'm writing, when I get an idea for a cartoon, it's right there. And then that cartoon is giving me other ideas. I worked very hard on this book to make it seem conversational. And that was actually the hardest thing to write correctly. I'm not a bad talker, and people say, well, you could tape it. You can't tape it. You've got to write it. And then, okay, here I could go on for pages and pages, or I could just compress everything with this cartoon that says it completely.
It was like sitting around with somebody's album where your host says, you know, let me just show you that.
Yeah.
It's perfect. How does the cartoon work with the New Yorker mix, you know, the magazine that has given us both the funniest and the gravest writing of our century?
It gives the magazine a sense of humor in that the humor is not confined. Now, you do have shouts and murmurs in your door, but there it's confined. Okay, these are pages, and that's wonderful, you know. But it's not a comic supplement to the magazine. It's integrated with the magazine, has a certain antic side to it, and yet does not refer to anything in the magazine. That's very, very unusual. So the magazine seems to be just more free as this parallel universe that is part of the New Yorker runs right alongside it.
Thank you so much.